Thank you very much, Sylvia. I'd like to, we're not at questions yet. We have a discussant for a few minutes, so please hold your question. Thank you. Our discussant is Sophie Bjork-James, who is a doctoral student at CUNY Grad Center in Anthropology. I'll just give you some highlights of the work she's been doing. One thing that I find interesting looking at her CV and the description that she gave me of her own work is the way that she's done kind of sustained research on what we might call the right in North America. Her master's thesis was The Apartheid Conscience, What the White Nationalist Movement Can Teach Us About Reproduction of White Supremacy in America. There's that R word again. And her PhD dissertation is The Political Ethics of Intimacy in American Evangelicalism. And she recently co-organized a conference on the Tea Party in U.S. set. So I look forward to hearing your comments about Sylvie Federici's talk. Thank you, Sophie.
Thank you, Rudy. Okay, so feminists in the 1970s organized campaigns demanding wages for housework, envisioning working for and providing theoretical tools to understand the devaluing of women and reproductive work under capitalism. Seeking to change the unequal conditions created by a gender division of labor inside and outside of the home, they sought compensation by the state for the undervalued work of reproduction. 40 years later, as Federici tells us, rather than emancipation, we have a major reproduction crisis. Her talk helps us to understand the dynamics between gender and neoliberalism that have led to this crisis. She begins with the surprisingly simple yet often neglected idea that without the work of preparing food, of keeping a house, and all the other means of reproducing life, that we would not be able to sell our labor. Federici shows how this unwaged reproductive work is a pillar of capitalist accumulation and of the exploitation of women under capitalism. She shows us that home and family are not the other of the factory system, but its foundation. Unwaged work within the home is thus devalued within capitalism, but also within theories of capitalism. It is not a natural remainder outside of the economy, as theorized by Hegel in the philosophy of right, and not a natural path outside of capitalism, as theorized by Marx. But instead, as Federici explains, capitalism is founded on the devaluation of reproductive work. Federici thus employs a key methodological tool used by feminist anthropologists, asking, how can we understand systems differently, cultural, economic, social, etc., when we look at the role of gender in structuring these systems? And, as is commonly the case, we often come to understand them quite differently. Federici shows us how failing to understand the gendered way that capitalism developed limits our ability to understand how capitalism continues to expand. So ironically, 40 years after the Wages for Housework campaign demanded pay for reproductive work, wages for housework are actually quite common today, although in a very different form than those envisioned by feminist organizers. In middle and upper class homes, particularly in global cities such as New York, professional women's success in waged employment has often occurred alongside of the outsourcing of housework and child rearing. maybe that's next. To women with less class power, often for minimal wages. And globally, the expansion of market values, monetization, and primitive accumulation into ever more areas and arenas has led to a widespread assault on women's ability to continue to reproduce traditional economies, leading to massive movements of women, with many migrating from the developing world to the EU and North America for employment and caregiving work as nannies, housekeepers, nurses' aides, etc. What Federici guides us through and helps us to understand is the complicated history where two significant historical changes emerged almost coterminously, at least within the same decade, that of a popular feminist movement challenging gender roles and leading to significantly more women working in the waged workforce, and soon after, the emergence of the new form of capitalism we call neoliberalism. So soon after women were entering the waged workforce en masse, challenging the historical devaluation of women's work and the exclusion of women from many parts of the economy, capitalism itself was changing, expanding into new areas and restructuring reproductive work globally. And importantly, neoliberalism has even less regard for reproductive work than Fordism prior. The wage workforce has not changed to accommodate family needs. Cuts in state services alongside people working longer hours has meant care for children and the elderly is increasingly challenging, creating a crisis in reproduction. And it is in this area of varied responses to the crisis of reproduction engendered by neoliberalism that I want to note three themes that I see are important sites for further discussion, particularly for anthropology. So the first is the emergence of microcredit that Federici just discussed. Originally designed to provide credit to those unable to receive it through traditional banks, the proliferation of microcredit has had the effect of bringing more of subsistence work into the waged economy and under the control of banks. Recognizing the role of women in challenging the commercialization of land and other forms of subsistence reproduction, this new means of utilizing women's networks as tools to expand reliance on wages and control of banks seems especially pernicious. Given the increasing prominence of micro-lending practices and banks, and given anthropology's potential in studying on-the-ground dynamics of global economies and local cultural and gendered practices, there is need for more ethnographies and microcredit practices. The second theme I want to raise is touched on in Federici's work, but I think it can be expanded upon further to help understand the complexity of politics in neoliberal times, particularly in the United States. And that is the symbolic role of reproduction and the imagining of the home as a space outside of capitalism. And I guess my interest in this comes from my own work on studying right-wing movements. So Eli Zaretsky's Capitalism, the Family, and Personal Life shows that capitalist society is defined by a split between personal life and economic life. And within the split, the family has served as an imagined reprieve from the alienating and impersonal market. In her book, Revolution at Point Zero, Federici talks about the double character of reproduction, of reproductive work as both that reproduces us and valorizes us, not only in view of our integration in the labor market, but also against it. With the crisis in reproduction, the shrinking of space and time to dedicate to reproductive activities in the home, this imagined reprieve of the home as a space outside of the competitive marketplace and as a site of valorization of identities is often felt as its own crisis. And given that historically this arena was understood as symbolically female and based on the feminine virtue of nurturance, it seems that the crisis in reproduction is sometimes understood as a gender crisis. And this is something that I came to see in my own work. As a scholar of conservative social movements in North America, I have found that economic forces are often understood as social forces. And in my research on both the contemporary white nationalist movement and the contemporary evangelical movement, I found surprising agreement by both groups where they blame feminism as opposed to neoliberal economic forces for the increasing work demands put on men and women, the challenges to families, and decreasing resources. Thus, their solutions for this economic crisis, which is felt as a crisis in reproduction, is to attempt to reassert traditional patriarchal gender relations. And it is here that Federici's analysis of the structural role of reproduction and gender in capitalism is useful. So in the United States, under an ongoing economic crisis, national political debates have often recently focused almost as much on debates about biological reproduction, birth control, abortion, as on economic issues, both of which are key symbols representing feminine values, as shown in Faye Ginsburg's Contested Lives. So unpacking the symbolic struggles that undergird political struggles, the intertwined in restructuring of reproduction and the economy are important sites for further exploration. So thank you.
Sure, yes, I love questions. Yes.
Yeah.
So we'll open the floor to
questions.
And Sylvia Federici will field her own questions.
In Europe, we say that capitalist one man exploits the second one, but in socialism it's reversed. The second exploits the first. And I don't understand why you're describing a family like a factory of cars, General Motors or something, reproduction. This is about crisis in economy. This is not crisis and relativistic philosophy. If you add to economic crisis, you have this problem. I don't think so that we have a crisis of family if we have, because we have a crisis in economy. We must separate credit banks from speculative banks. This is Glass-Steagall 1933 legislature. What do you think? What did you say about globalization here? It support families or something prevent?
No, I think, some other question too, so maybe pick up a few. Yeah. We pick up a few, two or three, yes.
Pick up a little bit on Sophie, because I think it was nice that she brought in the whole business of outsourcing reproduction to women of working class and also third world immigrant women, because I think that's part of what's been going on for the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. Of course, more women entering the workforce. So I'd like to talk a little bit about what the impact of the double day is. But underneath all of that is the question of who should be doing reproduction outside of this capitalist, we'll pay wages for somebody to come clean the house, we take care of our kids, care for our older people and so forth. Who should be doing reproduction if we're going to keep it somehow out of the market? So how would you...
Mm-hmm. Okay. One more? Then another question, and then is there another question? No? Okay. Then, I'm not sure I know how to respond to the question you have. I can only say this, that, first of all, the family. There are many, many types of families. So I'm talking about a specific type of family. And I was talking about specific history, which is the history of feminism, of the women's movement, and of the critique of the women's movement about gender relation and family relation. So I was speaking about that. I was not speaking about the world in general, but I spoke about the feminist critique and the particular type of analysis of the family and domestic labor. So this is what I was speaking about. And, of course, it's open to many viewpoints, but certainly the feminist movement, which was a mass movement, an international mass movement, was a movement that put their family into crisis and refused in many ways. For example, the relations of the unequal power relations on which their family was built, even in the best of cases. For instance, the fact that in the traditional family, women are economically dependent on men. It's very simple. When you have to ask money for another person for your survival, you are in a power relation. And that creates a whole new dynamic that I'm sure you would find objectionable if you were in it. Right? Now, the global economy, the crisis today, there is absolutely also a crisis that has to do with the global economy. In fact, what is happening is that with the restructuring and the precarization of labor, right? It's very interesting. In fact, I think that what is happening now as a consequence of the global economy, the crisis in the global economy, right? In a sense, it tells the truth of what was happening in that family. Because we have seen that the moment in which the male wage has entered into crisis, so has that kind of family. Today, in the United States, for instance, proletarian women marry less and less and less. Marriage survives among families who have two incomes. But people who have nothing in many cases have to go different places to look for an income, you know. And this is now becoming a world condition. I understand that in many parts of Latin America and so on, now the family is the woman and her children. And first of all, there's been an incredible amount of migration, right? The family has disintegrated also under the impact of migration. And also the fact that the moment of the male wage, which means that, in fact, the traditional family was, in fact, built around the male wage. And the moment that wage, and in fact, I would say that this is one reason why there's been, in my view, such an escalation of violence, male violence against women, which I think is beginning to become statistically significant. And I see it in Europe, there's been an immense escalation. And I'm not even talking about the return of witch hunting. I'm not even talking about the violence that permeates microcredit. But I'm talking about the fact that on a day-to-day basis, there is a level of violence. I know about a number of countries. I've seen the statistic of a number of countries, beginning with Italy, which is where I originally come from, where, in fact, the amount of murders of men in the family, fiancé, husbands, etc., who are killing their wives, who are killing their partners, has escalated tremendously. And clearly has to do with the fact that women are asserting more their independence, and has to do with the fact that the lack of a wage, the lack of money, lack access makes it also more difficult to mediate the relationship with women. So in a way, violence takes the place of all kinds of tools that before were of a more monetary form. But that said, I agree, you know, I didn't have the time today. I had to decide what to leave out. There was a lot that I had to leave out, and I have to jumble up because in 45 minutes it's impossible, you know. But so I left out, in fact, that the whole part about the restructuring. And I agree. In fact, I think that there is the crisis of reproduction is global, right? The crisis of reproduction is global. We are in crisis because obviously, you know, it's very clear after 4 decades of women being, at least in the U.S. and Europe, being massively present in the wage workforce, that there's not been emancipation through wage labor. I think the women have gained more autonomy with regard to men. And I think that the mediation, the male wage worker mediation between women and the state, women and capital, that has broken. Or at least has entered into crisis, eh? Right. Yeah. Yeah, so there is autonomy from, more autonomy from men, less autonomy from capital, or at least an tremendous amount of autonomy of dependence, yes. And so you have women who are basically living in a day-to-day crisis, total crisis, because you have no time for yourself. You are, you know, sometimes you have a job, you have a child, and you have a sick relative, and it's not true that housework has gone out to the home. Actually, there's a tremendous amount of housework, unpaid labor that women do. And a lot of housework has also come back into the home and is continuing to come back into the home through the cuts in social services and the cuts in hospital care, home care. So there actually people have to do in the home services that in the past were doing in a clinic, were doing on an institutional basis by people who have some expertise. So in fact, that's an incredible. And in fact, you see what women have reduced having children. In fact, you know, basically all across the world, in fact, and the number of children the women have has been, basically living in a situation where, you know, in many cases reproduction is done in New York, you know, by teenagers. I think that, and those who are most in danger also are the elderly. You know, people are not self-sufficient as elderly. You know, I read stories, documents about in New York, 11, 12 years old, giving injection to their grandmother or grandfather in the house because both parents are at work And now, yeah, all the fathers, yeah. And that's...
There's sort of the angle solution, which is like, you know, take all of that out of the home and communalize it, sort of like with laundries and kitchens and so forth. And then there's the...
It's the question of, oh, Cass, you ask how it that is, yes. I think that there is, right. Well, I think.
How do you have more reproductive, I mean, how do you get some of these things that you can't outsource still done by people?
Right. Well, so my theory, what I would say is that, the work of reproducing human beings and the work of reproducing ourselves is not oppressive if it's not done for oppressive goals. It depends, you know, the idea that, you know, human beings have always tried and will continue to try to find ways and also technological ways, techniques to reduce the works that we don't want to do. But also it's very, very important to know that what makes certain forms of activity so painful and so destructive is not necessarily the activity itself, but the social relations under which they are carried out and the objectives for which they are performed. So my conception would be that in a society in which the goals of reproduction are not the exploitation of labor, the exploitation of human being, the work of reproduction itself, you know, will not be as oppressive and generative of unequal relation as it has been in this history. That what has made this work so oppressive has been because the goal was not to reproduce human beings for their happiness or for their fulfillment or for our fulfillment. That this has never been the objective of society. That the objective of society has not been the pursuit of happiness, but it's been the pursuit of exploitation. And once that challenged, right, that's what we have to challenge. Then the labor itself, you know, because, for example, the beautiful idea of Marx that all necessary labor will be done by the machine, and then we will write poetry in the afternoon, go fishing in the morning, write poetry in the afternoon, and review critiques. First of all, there is no child care there, right? Where's the time for that? Obviously, Marx was not planning to do any child care. Right? Eh?
Marx never worked. He was on charity. Of how you can on microcredit buy Victoria's Secret?
Well, but this was the utopia, right? So he was not talking about his personal economic misfortune, but this was the representation of his utopia. And I'm saying the utopia itself was a bit problematic, right? But also, not only, you know, there's a lack of, child care and so forth, but also is the idea that somehow there is something, you know, necessarily oppressive in caring for others. There's not oppressive, you know, for example, in cooking a meal, unless you have to cook it in 5 minutes, you have no money about the way you choose, unless you are alone, and unless you are, et cetera, in all the conditions that make it oppressive, and every day you have to do it, and again, you do it in a... So I would see a society in which, in fact, we could return to look at reproductive labor as something that can be creative, and where the issue of caring for children, reproducing ourselves, producing our bodies, reproducing our souls, can actually have the attention, the passion, the creativity that is now supposed to pertain, you know, only to production for the market. Yeah. you have, and then there was,
I have a roundabout question, but I'll
Sure.
So you were talking about the propagation of these practices of primitive accumulation through European and North American dominated institutions like the World Bank or the IMF, and it made me think of a chapter in Caliban and the Witch.
Mm-hmm.
You began to talk about this kind of transmission of what you call the patriarchy of the wage.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Processes of colonization,
mm-hmm.
where then these European notions and practices are spreading. and to me, it's the most powerful part of the book, and I found it really useful in engaging men in anti-violence work. And it made me think, on the other hand, about a gathering I was at last week, which was focused, like a big foundation-funded gathering, focused on ending violence against women and girls, where rather than talking about what you were naming in terms of microfinance or witch hunts or the privatization of land, right, there's a focus when talking about the former third world on female genital mutilation, on this particular portrait of sex work, and these very, I would say, imperialist notions of saving third world women from third world men and from each other. And I guess my question is what to make of those efforts of mostly, in my experience anyway, white-dominated anti-violence work and organizations, and how to really move that toward addressing some of the stuff you're talking about. And I guess for me, in that setting also, one of your pieces from your new book really came up in conversation around understanding sex as work. And I just was curious if you wanted to speak about that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, then.
This is very different, on a different angle at all. It's also a question of, I work in an area in Yemen, rural. 30 years ago, it was largely subsistence agriculture. And the economy was just getting monetized. As it's becoming monetized, the country's becoming urbanized. Women have much less work to do in agriculture. It's cash cropping. And there are pressures to seclude them. Okay, so this is the background. In 83, when women would tell me, yes, I had 7 children, 8 children, but if I knew they would all survive, I would stop at 4. Now, young girls are getting 9, 12, 14 children. I mean, these are 30 years old, 35, 40-year-olds. Why? What's the connection between less work? I think in that society, parenting is highly valued, and children are still highly valued. But why would you go from... I just don't understand why suddenly you have to have 14 children.
I wouldn't know either. I would have to know, you know, where the women, which class they are from, and so on. Because my knowledge is that you are right. Large number of children have never been women's desires, and they've had them only because two reasons, you know, either very patriarchal situation in which you have to have children because it's a sense of male power, et cetera, et cetera. But most important, it's because of poverty. You know, my understanding is it's because you're poor, you have many children. It's not that you're poor because you have many children, it's the other way around. That if you don't have pension, if you don't have any form of security against disease, against old age, et cetera, et cetera, you have to have at least 4, 5, 6 children, because some may be able to bring some money doing some work on the road or some sort of wage work. Some will work in some field. The girl will stay in the house taking care of the other children. And so there will be a certain security. The children are the asset of the poor. And that's why, you know, there's so much documentation. So I don't know why in this particular situation there would be this change. I haven't heard of anything similar coming from other areas. In fact, generally, the birth rate is going down, mostly because families have been separated, because many, many families have physically broken down, and also many women begin to go to work in sweatshops or migrate in domestic labor so young that many, many women, less women actually are able to have a family. You know? Yeah.
Not a poor community.
Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe this has to do with issues of prestige. I do not know that situation. I do not know. Malav, yeah, where do I begin answering your question? Yeah, the issue of the patriarchy of the wage, I think is very important. I mean, I spoke of the patriarchy of the wage because obviously, the question of patriarchy, you know, patriarchy is an institution that traverses many, many different type of society. Not all, but many type of society. And it's very important not to see it in a kind of monolithic way and frozen way, but in fact it has changed. It is not so, you know, it's been very important in my work to show that capitalism refounds patriarchy, gives it new foundation, does not inherit it. But actually, capitalism has changed the world, has turned relationship upside down. The fact that, you know, patriarchal forms of relationship are still there is not because of the weight and the inertia of this relation, but because these relations have been found to be useful, and therefore they have been actually refounded, reconstructed, and they have been, I call it patriarchy of the wage, because it's clear that in capitalism the material support for patriarchal relation has been the wage. I mean, the whole dependence of women from men, for many, many women, has been that, you know, you depend on a husband, you know, for the years and years, he would be directed to the labor market and you're directed to the marriage market. You know, there are two different type of market, but one makes you dependent on another. And that's very, very important. I think that kind of patriarchalism, I think that type of patriarchalism today is in crisis. At least in many parts of the world is in crisis. I think there's a new type of patriarchalism that is emerging, you know. But I think that type of patriarchalism, which is why, by the way, I think that we had this massive intervention of the United Nations in women's politics. You know, for the whole period from 75, at least to Beijing plus one. You know, I think that when it became clear that that mediation of, you know, the male wage worker was in crisis, then and that in a sense, you know, there was now women demand and impose a direct relationship to capital, a direct relation to the state. In a way, all kinds of institutional forms had to be changed. And that's where the United Nations come in. I always make the parallel between the role of the United Nations with regard to the feminist movement, you know, in the 70s and 80s, and the role that the United Nations had towards decolonization. Right? I mean, they resisted decolonization as much as they could, but once they realized that the anti-colonial struggle could not be completely suffocated, then they placed themselves at the head of it. And if you read the brochures, I read a few brochures of from the United Nations, in fact, just the last few days, and the way they present their role in the decolonization process is really amusing. You know, they have done it. You know, you hardly knew that there was a big anti-colonial struggle and lots of people, et cetera, et cetera. And that decolonization was very selective, you know, very selective. But in any case, you know, that basically they had to place themselves at the head of it to blunt its more radical forms and make sure that you know, the feminization of politics would occur in ways compatible with the neoliberal agenda. In fact, within a decade and a half, feminism, global feminism, the new UN-made global feminism has become a prop of the neoliberal agenda. Eh? You know, for example, the kind of movement that have come out from Beijing, right? For example, the women land rights movement, that have been promoted in Africa and in part of Latin America, you know, coming out of Beijing. Their movement there, they are completely supportive of their neoliberal agenda because they demand constitutional reforms that strengthen private property clauses and, in fact, go very much in the direction of the type of legal reforms that the World Bank are wanting to institute, right, so that, you know, with individual titling, et cetera. And that's, in fact, the kind of reform, what reform means today. Land reform means in fact, that kind of reform, right? More property laws to strengthen property laws so that women are not discriminated against, as they often are in Africa, for instance, where even when the husband dies, even if they own land together, you know, she stands, you know, very much in danger of being expropriated by their relatives. Right? Yeah.
Depends on the part of Africa or not.
Well, in many parts of Africa, that's been, you know.
But there are many parts where that doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Never loses her own land.
Uh-huh.
And where women are more independent than they are in Europe and the United States. And that anthropologists who work in parts of Nigeria, particularly with Yoruba, where you worked all.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I was not in the Yoruba land. I was in the other part of
essentially being a witch was a powerful thing, as were the deities. It was not a negative thing. Expression as was. And they were incredibly more independent than women in Europe and the United States. And they were, in some ways, the women had autonomously gathered against colonial powers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, physically gathered against them and used their bodies as a way of stopping them. And they also participated at the national level. I found that that the whole European thing about phenogenital mutilation just didn't understand at all what was happening there or even what their reasons for it. So I think that ethnographies that some of us have done during this period recently, I haven't been to Nigeria since I left in 79 and haven't returned or anything, but I think that a lot of European concepts about what's happening, including the workers, that it really has to be more clearly embedded in some of the ethnography that has been done about gender relations there. But they were way ahead of European women. They were never as subordinated as European women were, and much of that has to. And they were way ahead sexually.
No, I read about the above women's war and so on, but you know, there's been a lot also that's been happening. I really do not know. I think you're right, it's a mistake to generalize, but I think there's a large amount of documentation coming, particularly in the last two decades. First of all, we have witch camps in Ghana. We have witch camps in Ghana. We have women who are being killed in massacres in the Gizi part of Kenya, and it's not over. Many women have been killed in Tanzania. Women have been killed in South Africa. Also older men, not only women, also older men. So that has actually been taking place. You know, the process of structural adjustment, the kind of land grabs that have taken place in recent years, I think the destruction that the mining companies have operated, where entire villages have been, you know, it's really changing the condition in very fundamental ways. I know the situation, for example, that, you know, Ole Soyinka describes Ake and the struggle the women did, colonialism, when they sitting on a man and et cetera, was very, yes. But women had their own crops. Women had land. women had access to land. This is exactly what is now being taken away. For example, they know in Kenya, in many parts of Kenya now, the men refuse to pay the bride price. Because once you pay the bride price, right, then you have to also give a certain amount of land to your wife. This is part of the kind of marriage contract because it is assumed that women will not be dependent on men, that they will have their own land. And if they go outside of their clan, outside of their group, they will have to have their own land. So now the men are refusing to pay. These are in the very same areas because as the land, and more than that, as the land shrinks because you have the chiefs giving away the land to the agrofuel and so on, then the laws of belonging, the rules of belonging, who belongs, who has the right to the land, are being continuously redrawn. A lot of the land struggles that are now taking place. And of course, there are many, many interests behind it, right? And so that situation of power the women had, they had a very material basis on the fact that they could have their own crops, they could sell the produce, they could sell it. It's not necessarily there now. But,
I think we're going to have to bring this to an end, as interesting it has been. So I'll turn it over to Rudy.
Well, I just want to, I'm not surprised that we're ending on such a lively, kind of controversial note. I think if we invite Sylvie Federici, that's exactly what we're getting in for, which is delightful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for stimulating.